On this episode of The Flatus Show, number 61B, the continuation of my interview with podcaster Randy from the Two Guys, One Brain podcast. We talk about the sheriff's office, woodworking, divorce, mall security, flying, and colds. I also have a little segment on Buzzkashi. This and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Well, that's the tab. This is, of course, the second part. If you want to hear the tab can open, go back to 61A. I think it's 61A, yeah, and you'll hear the tab can open. Because I'm drinking the same tab can. Only one tab can per week. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, oh, I have heartburn. Welcome to the Flatus Show. This is Kenty. And you can reach me at kenty@theflatusshow.com. Also, you can reach me at 206-339-JOSE. Leave me a voice comment. You can reach me at theflatusshow.com. And let's see what else. I want to talk about What I Believe podcast again, just to, for those who are just listening to this particular part of the two-part episode. What I Believe podcast is the podcast I do with Big C. From Pulling My Pod podcast, and that's it's a weekly podcast. This episode is the second part of the interview I did with Randy from the Two Guys One Brain podcast. Randy and Andy host the Two Guys One Brain podcast out of Vancouver, Washington, and they talk about their family, their work in the county jail they work. And camping and poker and all sorts of things that they enjoy doing. And it's very good, very well done, well produced. Somebody should pay them to do it. It's so good. Pardon me. It's the tab. Anyway, this is going to be short because there's not much more to say. But I did want to talk about Buzzkashi. Now, what is Buzzkashi, right, Kenty? It's a traditional Afghan, Turkic, and Mongolian sport. This is from Wikipedia, wikipedia.org, for all your information need. The free encyclopedia. Anyway, it's played on horseback. Now, in my notes, audio show notes in part one of this two-part episode, horseback games are for aristocrats in Europe. Football is a game that you play on foot, and it's for the peasants. And, of course, American football comes from that. There's medieval games. But Buzzkashi is played on horseback. And the Persian name translates literally to goat grabbing. And what it is that they take a goat and take off its legs and its head and fill it up with sand, and then they – I don't know what they do. They, like, carry it around. So – it's very interesting. They can use a calf, too. And they soak it in cold water to make it. I'm just, you know, going through the notes here on the Wikipedia page. They soak it in cold water to make it tough. But what they do is they take the bone, the carcass, and pick it up and take it to the goalpost, I guess. And they play it on the steppes of Central Asia. Is that what it says here? The steppes, the steppes of Central Asia, the Uzbeks and the Kyrgyzstans and Kazakhs and Dungan and Turkmen, all those people play it on horseback. They are the Ali Khan and, you know, all those people, the nomads of Central Asia. So, anyway, so that's that. I just want to mention that. I mean, you know, maybe we ought to bring that to America. Do you think that'd be really popular in the big stadiums? Goats and horses and all sorts of things. I think it's kind of violent. I think Americans would like it. So anyway, Buzzkashi shows up in a lot of fiction. It is featured in the movie Rambo 3. And it's also in a novel by Joseph Kessel called Le Cavaliers, The Horseman. And it was filmed... features Omar Sharif, features that. It's also in the book Caravans by James Michener. and in the film. It is in that film of that movie. And John Cusin's film, The Man Who Would Be King, is a Buzkashi is featured briefly. So anyway, that's that. That's all I wanted to talk about. Give you some extra information, because I know how much you love that. Now, on with the show. Bible reading to confuse the Orthodox believer. First Corinthians chapter 2. And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God, for I determined not to know anything among you, save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Howbeit, we speak wisdom among them that are perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that come to naught. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom, which God ordained before the world unto our glory, which none of the princes of the world knew. For had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God knoweth no man, but the Spirit of God. Now, we have received not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God. Which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness upon him, neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. But he that is spiritual judgeth all things, yet he himself is judged by no man. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. I find this very interesting because of the word hidden. Now, the Gnostics believed in a hidden knowledge, and it was a secret knowledge. And I think that that's what this chapter talks about, is that the Holy Spirit, it really does, you know, God does work through people. And you know, if you want to believe in the Trinity, then I guess the Holy Spirit does do these things, but not all people. Now, who is a Christian, right? That's the question. So I would have to say, according to this, it's a Christian who has this secret knowledge. But are all people who call themselves Christians really Christians? You know, I mean, you know, that's the question, I guess, or is a question, whether it's important or not, I don't know. But I find it interesting, this hidden wisdom. So I think Gnosticism really, you know, probably was much more prevalent at this time and actually informs a certain part of Christianity, which has since, you know, it's not a big major force, I guess, Gnosticism. But I still think it appears in the Bible. And I think it's part of about the understanding of God. Now, secret doesn't mean that it has to be, you have to go through a secret society or at all, right? Or you have to do certain things to get it. Secret means is that God brings people to Jesus, right? I think it says it somewhere in the Bible. I don't have the – I could read the quote and find it, but if – you know, whoever's listening to this – my listeners are smart enough to know who can find these things. But anyway, it says something about God bringing those to Christ. So maybe that's what it is. There's only a few people who are brought to Christ, and that's that, you know. With the rest of us, I don't know. But, you know, but I think also sometimes you don't necessarily even know that you're a Christian. I think God works through people, and they don't even know. They don't have, you know what I'm saying? I think God can do whatever he wants. But I really believe that that's true. There are people who don't even know that they're, that God is working through them. But anyway, that's all I have to say about this. Gnosticism, hidden wisdom, hidden wisdom. So, and I also believe you don't need to read the Bible to get any kind of wisdom from the Holy Spirit. I think the Holy Spirit reveals himself to you all the time in everything, so that you don't need to see a Bible. See, that's something I believe is also about the Bible is needed or whatever. I don't really think it's needed. I mean, if God exists, he's going to tell you what he wants done in some way. He's going to communicate to you. Let's say all the Bibles were destroyed. God still exists, right? And he's going to tell you what, you know, he's going to tell you what you need to do. If you believe in that kind of relationship. I had a conversation with a friend about this, special revelation and whatever, all these different types of way God reveals himself. And I said, suppose God is still working. Couldn't he inspire to be write another book to the Bible, you know? Like doing, you know, like, you know, how would it be chosen, you know? So I still think is that people who put too much faith in the Bible and not enough faith in God. And so another thing is, I believe, is that once Christ came upon on the earth, that the Old Testament laws do not pertain to modern man to be specifically followed the way they're said, because God, as Jesus Christ, gave us the golden rule: do unto others as others should do unto you. And he talked about all the different laws. He codified them, you know. In the past, I suppose, they need to be specifically stated: don't do this, don't do this. But that's not what God meant. And so as man, you know, whatever, got smarter or whatever during the time of Christ, and even up today, I mean, we all have different culture, right? So you have to interpret the law, I guess, and I believe, you know, maybe the Holy Spirit does that, but I don't believe you should be looking at the Old Testament for behavior, you know, those rules have nothing to do with being sanctified. So anyway, that's my humble opinion, my own religious humble opinion, and I'm sure there are some people who call it heresy, but I call it belief. There you go. So many nights I'd sit by my window waiting for someone to sing me his song. So many dreams I kept deep inside me alone in the dark, but now you've come along and you light up my life. You give me hope to carry on. You light up my days and fill my with song. Rolling at sea, adrift on the waters, could it be finally I'm turning for home? finally a chance to say, hey, I love you. Never again to be all alone. And you light up my life. You give me hope to carry on. You light up my days and fill my nights with song. For you, you light up my life. You give me hope to carry on. You light up my days and fill my night with song. It can't be wrong when it feels so right, 'cause you light up my life. So after you were left the Georgia Pacific, then you joined the jail, right? Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what made you, what attracted you to that?
Well, it was kind of an accident. Left Georgia Pacific, I always tell people they fired me. I was technically laid off. I mean, there was a lot of us, you know. Our jobs disappeared. They didn't exist anymore. So there was a little bit of a severance involved there, but it was all stuff that I'd earned, you know. It was, a vacation that I hadn't used yet,
yeah,
and, you know, things like that. It wasn't like they just said, here, because we're screwing you over, take some cash to make it a little easier on yourself. It was all stuff I had coming to me. But it was like, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 grand. So I used that money and started a furniture business. I started making custom furniture and other things, cabinets, things like that. And I did that for about 8 months. And it was going pretty well. I was making decent money. I was making enough money to support my wife and 3 kids at that point. And it was good. But again, no health insurance. It, you know, you only got paid if you worked. You had to collect the money yourself. You had to run the business yourself. I enjoyed it, and I would have continued doing it, but my wife was used to the amount of money that I was making, the fact that we had a company car, and the fact that we had a pretty good health plan. Mm-hmm. She was used to the security of that and felt very vulnerable without it. Mm-hmm. Even though everything was going well, if something catastrophic would have happened, it wouldn't have taken long to be in trouble. Yeah. And, you know, so I could see her point. It was difficult for me not to take it personally, because I was as happy as I'd ever been, you know, not working for somebody else. I was working for myself. So I was very happy, a lot less stress, but I could see her point. Okay. So one day we have a friend of hers over at our house who happened to be dating a friend of mine. And he had been unemployed for quite a while. In fact, he worked for one of those big corporations. Georgia Pacific bought the paper mill that he worked at, and he was out. And he ended up unemployed for quite a while. So he was going down literally the next day. We're having dinner. She mentions in the conversation, Bob's going downtown to test for the sheriff's office tomorrow. You should go with him. And I basically agreed to go to keep him company more than anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had never had any desire to be a cop. I just wasn't the, hey, I'm going to be a cop or an astronaut or a fireman type of guy. Mm-hmm. I was a blue collar, I'm going to work and do stuff type of guy. Yeah. So yeah. I went on a lark more than anything else. I hadn't prepared for the test. It's a public service test. But I went with him. I sat in. We do the test. And for whatever reason, I passed the test. So, and he didn't, as it turned out. So they send back a thing and say, hey, you passed the test. Come on in for an interview. And still, I wasn't really interested. I wanted to do my furniture thing. And at the time, the thing that attracted me to the job, to be perfectly honest, was the schedule. You work 4 days on, you have 4 12-hour days in a row, but then you have 4 days off. It's a really a great deal. So my intention was, I'll work the 4 days on, I'll get the health benefits and all those things that come with a public service job, but they don't pay that well. So the 4 days off, I'm going to continue to operate my business and make furniture and do these things. So that was my plan. And I ended up, I took the test in January and I started April 4th, April 5th, something like that. In public service, and particularly with the Clark County Sheriff's Department, that's fast. It usually takes about a year.
Really?
But from the time you take the first test until you get through all of the interviews, there's background checks that you have to go through. There's lie detector tests and drug tests and all kinds of things because they want to avoid the embarrassment of hiring a pedophile to work as a police officer, things like that. You know, so they make you jump through a lot of hoops. Nothing happens fast. But they were in a crunch for people, so I got hired relatively quickly, 4 months. And shortly after that, I ended up getting divorced. So I ended up selling the furniture business, and now all I do is the sheriff's office. But it turns out that I really enjoy it. I really like it. It's when I tell people that it's fun, and then I tell them some of the weird things that you end up dealing with, it seems contradictory. But overall, it's a very fun job.
Yeah, I have a question about the furniture store. Did you make furniture before that? Before you decide to do furniture, or how did you?
It's funny. It started out, I never was very handy with those things. In fact, I think I flunked a woodshop class. I wasn't good at it. But my grandfather was, my mom's dad, the one that I wrote the story about for you. Okay. He was a craftsman. He built clocks and cabinets, and I had a desk as a kid that he had built for my mom when she was a kid. He was good at it, very good, very meticulous, detail-oriented. If he made you something, it would last literally forever. Mm-hmm. He built his entire house that my grandmother lived in. He was that kind of a guy. Yeah. I never was. When he died, I inherited his tools. When I went home from his funeral, I rented a U-Haul and put the table saw and all that stuff in there and had it in my garage down in Sacramento and just started messing around, bought some books, and sort of took it up as a hobby. I think partly just because I missed him, you know, I could hang out with his tools because he wasn't around anymore. I'm not sure what motivated me, but I became pretty good at it. I ended up making most of the furniture in our house, all the end tables, coffee tables. There's a cabinet. It's actually called a pie safe, but it's basically a freestanding cupboard with some drawers and doors in it with the punch tin panels, things like that.
Oh, yeah, pie safe.
Yeah, pie safe. Yeah, I made one of those. I still have that. Mm-hmm. My wife had very expensive taste at the time, so she was shopping at Ethan Allen. She found a coffee table with not wings, leaves that folded up and down. Mm-hmm. So it was a coffee table, but if you wanted to entertain, it would fold up and become a much larger table. Mm-hmm. She wanted that, but it was like $800 or some ridiculous thing, and it was a piece of crap. I mean, I could tell by looking at it, it wasn't worth $800. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I made her one. And so I got good at it, building stuff for my own home. People would see it. Hey, I'd like one of those. Could you make me one? And I just sort of started doing that on the side. When I became unemployed, all of a sudden that was a way to make money. So we got an 800 number, started advertising in national magazines. We specialized. Like I would make my dad had a collection of old wooden milk crates. Like, now they're the plastic ones that you see out behind the grocery store. Well, they used to be made of wood and metal, and they had glass milk bottles in them. When he was working for the pizza place, he delivered cheese. So he was in and out of dairies all the time. He goes in one, and they have a big stack of all this old obsolete glass bottles and wood crates, and he bought them. So we ended up making furniture, like end tables and things, out of those tables. So we put it in a magazine. We sold those like crazy. I sent them clear to the East Coast. So, yeah, it was something that I taught myself to do and ended up making a living for almost a year at it.
Wow. Do you still have the equipment? And you kept the equipment, right?
Well, when I got divorced, I sold the business to my dad. Oh, so I sold all the equipment to him, mm-hmm. and I haven't really been involved since then.
I see. It's
all still there, and I could use it if I wanted to, but I don't do it as a source of income anymore.
Yeah. He still does furniture? Your dad?
Yeah, he has a different attitude towards it. I wanted to make really nice things that were unique and beautiful that you could, you know, they would take longer and you didn't do everything the easy way. I mean, there's a difference between a butt joint and a dovetail joint. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The dovetail is the better way to do it. It takes longer, it lasts longer, and it looks better. But a butt joint will work. So we were always at odds over that. I wanted to make things beautiful and nice that would last forever. He wanted to make them quick and get paid so he could make the next thing. So we kind of always had that conflict going. So I wanted to make quality. He wanted to make quantity.
You sound like a real craftsman. I'd love to see some of the stuff you did.
Well, when you come out here, we have some of it in the house.
Okay, well, I'll be out there.
We might have to go visit my ex-wife to see the rest because she got most of it.
Oh, geez. So that's, you know, interesting. You move back, you do this, and then, you know, within 4 months after you apply to the, the police department, right, you are divorced. I mean, that's pretty
quick. Well, it took about a year after. There was a lot of things that happened there. I from my last day at Georgia Pacific to my first day at the sheriff's office, I was making about half what I had previously made. Mm-hmm. Public service doesn't pay that well. Yeah. So I was as a salesperson, I was doing really well. As a public servant, I was doing average. And she was used to doing really well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think, you know, part of her decision was based on monetary reasons, which, you know, it ended a 17-year marriage, so you can probably imagine I was a little bitter to find out what was important and what wasn't. So, yeah, I have my difficulties with that, but I you don't hear me complain about it too much because I luckily, my children live with me. You know, I get them, I have them, and part of my contract with myself for being that fortunate is that I'm not going to expose them to me complaining about their mother, who they love. So I just don't do it.
Yeah. Well, that's smart. You know,
it was the worst time of my entire life without exception. But it's in the past, so I try not to dwell on it.
Well, that's good. I mean, I commend you. You know, I you talked about it, and I've often wondered what it was because, you know, you seem well-adjusted.
Well, I can tell you it would be a completely different story if I would have had to been a weekend dad for my three kids.
Yeah. You're very lucky.
Oh, huge. Don't think I don't know it every day. I'm very fortunate.
There is there's a guy who has a podcast, What the Fuck Was Jesus Doing? He, you know, I started listening to this podcast, and he was married. He is married. He has four kids. And everything's going fine. And then one podcast, you find out that his wife is leaving him. And so I think he's trying to save the marriage. And I think he wants to get the kids because he's taking care of the kids because according to the podcast, you know. But, you know, that's tough, you know. I can't imagine what that'd be like. But I'm glad to hear that you got the kids. And because generally, I think don't the women get the children?
I was in a bad, bad spot. We'd been married for 17 years. She had, when we first got married, when we first had Rachel, back in the old, really poor days, she worked as a waitress at Denny's for the first couple years we were married. But as soon as I started making enough money, she stayed home with the kids. And then for the next 14, 15 years, she didn't work. She didn't have to outside the home. Raising three kids, not easy. I understand that's a job. And we agreed that that's what she would do. When David got into school, my youngest, when he got into school for the full day, she wanted to get a job, which I was fine with that. Mm-hmm. So she started looking around. Well, the job she chose, it happened to be while I was making furniture, the job that she chose was flight attendant. So it's not like you just get up in the morning and go to work and come home that night and how was your day? Yeah. you know, yeah. she was getting on a plane and being gone for 3 days. Ooh, well, geez. that's the career that she wanted, and it was just, it was such a huge U-turn in our lives. It was, she went from being with the kids all the time, every day, being the room mom and the president of the PTA and organizing dances, and she was constantly involved, to, I'm a flight attendant now, I don't have time for any of you. In fact, I want a divorce. I'll see you in a couple of months.
Oh, my
God. She just disappeared. So, I mean, it was a huge change for us. It was a huge change for her, you know, still somewhat inexplicable. But because I am a go-to-work, work-all-day, come-home kind of guy now, even though for the almost our entire marriage, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I traveled all the time. At the time she chose to end our marriage, I was home and she was traveling, so I ended up with the kids just because of circumstances.
Oh, that's really interesting.
It's such an enormous life change. I mean, people constantly, yeah, when I tell them that, when people who knew her before and know her now, she's like two completely different people. The whole wow. situation is surreal a lot of the time.
Wow. She's still a flight attendant?
Yeah.
And she loves it, right?
Seems to. I mean, I've noticed, I may be a little tainted, but I've noticed that a lot of flight attendants, the majority of them, are pretty self-important. Mm-hmm. They're a lot of the same sort of cliched way people look at law enforcement. You know, arrogant, pompous, you know, my way or the highway type of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I know why we have that. And there are a lot of guys who are like that. So I know I'm generalizing. But flight attendants in general seem to think that their job is a lot more important than it is. And she's right up there. I mean, it, you know, to her, it's a matter of national security that she go to work and serve peanuts every day.
Uh-huh. So
I try not to be bitter about it, but sometimes it makes me laugh.
Yeah.
It is an important job if you're having a crisis. You know, if your plane's going to crash,
yeah.
those people are trained to keep you safe. But for the vast majority of the time, they pour you a half a Coke and give you a packet of peanuts.
Yeah, I know. I don't fly very often, but the few times I have flown, I got my peanuts from... I remember the first time I flew, the stewardess, she was must have been a stewardess for, I don't know, 40 years.
Yep.
She knew what she was doing. She kept you in line.
If you want to irritate them, call them stewardesses.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're not stewardesses anymore, Ken. They're flight attendants now.
Oh, okay.
Now.
I apologize.
If you use the S word, you'll get an earful.
You know what kind of male chauvinist pig I am. So it sounds pretty good. So, I mean, you've been doing the jail thing for... whatever, 8 years or 9 years or...
Yeah, going on eight.
8 years.
Yeah.
So...
It was nothing I ever would have chosen, but I really am very, very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can tell. I mean, I know from the podcast, I mean, from having, you know, heard all your, you know, heard your experiences.
It's not for everybody. And, I mean, if you hear some of the stuff that goes on, you think, what in the world kind of moron would subject themselves to that kind of thing on purpose. But at the same time, and you know what? It might go back to that whole joining the football team or belonging to a gang. There's a family there. Law enforcement people, and I found this out through our podcast, there are a lot of law enforcement people who listen to our podcast mm-hmm. who are almost instantly... I'm not sure what the right word is, but you're almost instantly familiar. You already know that person based on what little information you have. You know how they think. You know how they act. You know what's important to them.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. It's like a family within our department. And then when you're around other law enforcement people, it's like it's extended family, yeah. even though you've never met them. It's the same ilk, and I'm sure there are other industries that are like that.
I'm sure fire departments like that, and
sure.
Because there's only, you know, so many police officers and who have that kind of experience that
sure.
you know. So I can understand that.
I enjoy that feeling. I
yeah.
enjoy being a part of this team. I enjoy doing this job,
yeah.
and and, you know, for whatever reason, I didn't know I was cut out for it, but apparently I am.
Yeah. I understand completely, having worked in the Cambridgeside Gangsteria. I had death threats, and I ignored them. I really did. These kids were like, we're going to get you. I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. I should have been more wary, but I was like, you're not going to steal the rap tapes.
Oh, man.
Yeah. They just came in and did their stuff. Working in a mall is very much like working in a prison.
I can imagine. I don't like going to the mall just because of the similarities.
Yeah, it really is. It is. Each store is like its own little cell, and,
yep.
You know, it's true.
I see a lot of the same people there.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. And at the mall, right, there's this big the mall security guards knew the thieves. So yep. You would call them, the mall security, say, hey, you know, we're having a problem. And they would come and say, what's the problem? And then say, hey, Joe, how you doing? And then they'd be talking to their friends. It's like, where are you going to, you know, there's no justice, you know, there's no protection, really.
I think the background check for mall security is a little less strenuous than law enforcement. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You might get some racketeering going there.
Yeah, there's probably no background check.
No, some of them there's not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how it is now, but oh, well, what are you going to do? I'm out of there, so that's good. Still gives me nightmares.
Yeah, I actually still have the occasional, you know how most people share the dream of you're back in school and you don't have your homework and, oh, by the way, you're not wearing any pants?
Yeah.
I have similar dreams like that with my old sales job. I'm on a plane flying somewhere to make a presentation, and all of a sudden I realize I'm not prepared and, you know, I left my sample case at home, and yeah, I did not enjoy that job at all. Made lots and lots of money, but I was a miserable human being.
So you really found your way. I mean, it sounds like at a certain point in your life, I mean, everything just sort of fell into place. I mean, isn't it odd? Your wife is like, I'm going to become a flight attendant. You know, everything like turned 180 or 360 or whatever. Topsy turvy world.
Yeah, I constantly tell people, because I literally did hate that job. It was very stressful. I was not a very nice person because of it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're constantly doing something you dislike, it does affect your personality and the way you treat others, mm-hmm. including your family.
Mm-hmm.
So I was unhappy, but I know I never would have quit that job. You don't quit a six-figure job just because you don't like the work. You know, you don't go from $100,000 a year to $50,000 a year just because you're happier. You should. I mean, in retrospect, if I'd have known, I probably would have done it. But it's just not a decision that someone in that situation makes on their own. It was made for me, and thank goodness I'm probably going to live a lot longer because of it.
It's telling, you know, because it's true. I often think about that myself, is that, you know, I don't mind what I do, but I really don't do too much, really. I work in a cubicle.
There is certainly something to said for being happy.
Yeah, that's for sure. I find for me, all of my hobbies make me happier than any work I've ever done. So I don't know if I'll ever find a marriage between happiness and earning money. I don't really think it matters. Oh, well. Well, so here you are. So what do you expect to do in the next, you know, 10 years? Well, do you have any plans?
It's funny. Andy also works at the jail. Andy and I became friends there.
Mm-hmm.
Being a goal-oriented person in the past, you know, I mean, a lot of my income depended on it. Frankly, I mean, you have to meet a quota in order to earn a bonus or a commission. You're constantly doing projections, and you know, you probably know, working in a cubicle, things are asked of you that are tantamount to voodoo.
Yeah.
How much are you going to sell next year, and to whom? Well, how the hell should I know? You know, so you spend a lot of time doing that, which is busy work, which I think is why I hated it so much. And then you spend the next year trying to fulfill that prophecy that you made by the seat of your pants. But if you attain a goal, there's a reward. In public service, it's not like that. We're not selling anything. I, with my work ethic, which, you know, I admittedly is middle of the road, okay? There are officers that knock themselves out going above and beyond every day. I mean, if they don't have something to do, they'll find something to scrub with a toothbrush and make it shiny. I don't do that. But there are also officers who are the last ones to respond to a situation. They call in sick whenever they have enough sick time to do it. We all make the exact same amount of money. There's no incentive to be a better officer, regardless of what level an officer you are. The only way to make more money is longevity. You get an increase every year. It takes like 11 years to top out. And once you do that as an officer, that's as high as you go, unless you take another test and become a sergeant. You have to go up in rank to make more money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So kind of where I'm at now is, if I want to improve myself, if I want to be the goal-oriented person that I've always been, I need to start bucking for promotion. I need to maybe make sergeant, maybe make commander, maybe, you know, do something else, or be satisfied where I am. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of at a crossroads where I've been thinking about it for the first time since I've been with the sheriff's office. Mm-hmm. What do I want to do? Am I, you know, do I just want to be a senior officer? Because I have a lot of seniority now. Mm-hmm. We bid for position, our actual work schedule, based on seniority. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting to the point where I can work the hours I want, I can work the place I want, I can get the vacation I want. So now I have to decide, am I just going to remain even keel and retire as an officer, or am I going to try to move up in the sheriff's office? And that's a decision I haven't made yet. I don't know.
Hmm. Well, if you become a commander, right? How would that change your work schedule?
Well, as soon as you even sergeant is first, so you go from, we call it line staff. You're an officer. If there's a fight, you're the guy that runs in there and gets blood on you, breaking it up. If you become a sergeant, You work the same shift, you work with all those people, but you're the supervisor. You collect all the reports, you present them to the command staff, you make decisions, but you really don't do any of the dirty work. Mm. Well, becoming you also, when you become a sergeant, you go to the bottom of the sergeant seniority list. Mm. So the newest sergeant, even if you've been at the sheriff's office for 20 years, the newest sergeant gets to bid last for position, gets to bid last for vacation. So you make more money, but you go to the bottom of the stack again. Yeah. And then it takes much longer because there are fewer sergeants. You work your way up through that. Then you become a commander, which is basically a day shift, suit and tie, office-type job. You're handling budgets and personnel issues and dealing with the public and things like that. You don't even go in the jail if you don't want to. So I don't know if I'm ready for that. As a person, I'm conflicted because I don't generally like to just tread water, which is what I'm going to do if I don't promote. But at the same time, I'm pretty happy not having that kind of responsibility. You know, I don't have to guess what's going to happen next month, or I don't have to project what the budget for the jail is going to be next year. I don't have to worry about those things, and I make a good living.
It sounds like a sweet, it sounds like you have a really good sweet spot right now with your seniority and your schedule. Yep. And, I mean, the way you described commander, I mean, I wouldn't want to do that unless that was your career, that was your goal to begin with, you know?
A commander starts at about double what line staff makes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely motivated by money. A sergeant, to be quite honest, a sergeant, the increase in pay between a topped-out officer and a sergeant is not that much. It's, you know, like maybe 10-15%.
Yeah. No, it's not much.
It's not that much.
No. Mm-mm. The commander, though, sounds more dull, though, you know.
I totally agree. I completely agree. I don't see myself doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a dull thing. I mean, the money sounds good, but money's not everything, as you know.
And you know what? I think if I didn't already know that, I think if I'd have started here at the same time I started in sales, that would be my goal, would be to make command staff and make money and make decisions and, you know, be the guy in the suit. That would have been my goal. But having made that kind of money and realizing that happiness is worth something, I it's just not that important to me anymore.
Interesting. I'm sort of in the same position. I don't know what I want to do with my life when I grow up.
Well, you know, we got a lot of life left in us, Ken.
I know.
I don't think you need to hurry. You don't take your time.
Okay, I will. Well, is there anything else you want to add for the Flatus listeners to know about you?
You know everything there is to know about me now, Ken.
Oh yeah, now you met Wendy in a Sylvester the Cat suit.
Yeah.
Were you at a furry convention?
No, we were at Andy's Halloween party.
Oh, that okay.
And I went in a Sylvester the Cat costume that I borrowed from a friend of my daughter.
And that's how you met the lovely and talented Wendy.
Yeah, that was roughly our first date. I actually met her at work. She works there also. And I'd been divorced for about a year, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was looking good and I was ready. And I made some inquiries and it got back to her and she showed interest. And then next thing you know, here we are.
I see. Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So, and I don't know what's going to happen with that either. You know, we've lived together for 3 years or so now. We're not married. Don't really have plans on getting married. Mm-hmm. I'm perfectly happy the way it is. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason to be married again.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I mean, marriage is. I don't know what marriage is. Yeah. For some people.
The only thing that would motivate us, frankly, is her son Shane is 8 years old. Mm-hmm. His father died when he was 3, and he also worked at the sheriff's office. He's actually known me longer than he knew his dad, his paternal father. Let's put it that way. So the only thing that would motivate us, and I think it's a lousy reason to get married, but still worth considering, frankly, is legalities. What happens with him if something happens to her? I basically have no parental rights legally with him as my son, even though he's my son. As our family unit functions, that's the way it works. But legally, if something were to happen, I'd have a pretty tough way to go. And I think that's an issue that you've discussed before on your show and on the What I Believe show.
Yeah,
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah, you could probably get some sort of agreement, you know, like adopt them maybe. So we need to have like co-ownership, not co-ownership. Like, you know, there must be something like that out there. I mean, gays, you know, have to deal with that all the time in the other 49 states that aren't you know, up to modern times like us in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I'm sure there would be some way to make it easier, and like as we haven't done it, it won't be an issue until, you know, something happens, and then we'll say, gosh, I wish we would have done that.
Yeah, you should do something. I mean, I would urge you know, just to for his sake, you know.
I agree with you, Ken. We probably ought to do something about that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll look into that.
Yeah.
You've inspired me.
Oh, good. Good, I'm glad. That's just for the child's sake. I mean, it's only for, 10 more years, right?
Yeah.
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 Then he makes his own decisions.
Oh, he makes his own decisions now.
Oh.
But when they have legal weight to them, 10 years. Well, I sure am looking forward to you guys coming out here. We've met now. We've had two different listeners. Both happen to have been from California. Mm-hmm. Come up here and visit and be on our show. It has been really neat.
I heard Peacekeeper on your show today.
That was kind of a surprise. I mean, we only found out a couple of weeks ago he was coming up here on his vacation, and it happened to be on a day we were already having a function here. It's my oldest daughter's 21st birthday party. Her birthday was a few days ago, but we had the party yesterday, and he happened to show up during that, so we're having a barbecue and a party. Everybody that we refer to on the show was here, and I'll tell you, he fit right in. I was talking to Emma about it because he was very comfortable here. He brought his wife and his small son. They walked right up. It was like they already knew us all. We chatted. We have a karaoke machine. We all sang karaoke. I mean, it was just a big party like we were old friends. And I was talking to Emily about it, and I'm pretty sure it's because he already knew us all. He, even though we'd never met him, he knew us just based on listening to the show.
I feel like so I know you.
Yeah, I feel the same way. So he was very comfortable being here, and that's really something. I mean, the whole podcast phenomenon is really something.
I agree.
It really is neat, and I've met people I wouldn't have met otherwise. I wouldn't be talking to you otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it's been really cool. It's become a pretty big part of our daily life, you know, creating them or listening to them. It's really something.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's true. I haven't met anybody yet from the podcast, but I am planning on coming out to Washington. We have a friend who lives out in San Francisco, so we're thinking about making a trip to go down there and then fly up and, you know, sort of like do the West Coast.
Sure, it's a quick flight from the Bay Area.
Yeah, yeah, he was saying it's fairly cheap too to fly out there. I don't know, I mean, I don't really fly that much, and so I don't know.
Yeah, Bay Area to Portland, anywhere up and down the West Coast is pretty reasonable.
That's good to know.
Getting out here, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah,
from where you are in San Francisco might be a little pricey.
Yeah, well, we'll figure it out. We can. He actually, our friend in San Francisco, he's a he works for a big company as their travel guy. He like plans all of the trips. His company does a lot of business. I mean, it's a huge multi-million dollar company, so they do a lot of travel, and they hired him to save money, you know? Sure. And he's really, over the whatever number of years he's worked there, he's really reduced their expenses. They love him, so.
So he can hook you up.
He'll hook me up, yeah. He'll hook us up.
Well, I tell you, I can't wait.
Yeah,
and like I say, we got a bigger trailer just for you, so you'd have somewhere to stay.
I'm touched.
It's like a condo.
I know. I think it looks bigger than our place here.
Oh, it's bigger than my first apartment. I know that.
Yeah, it looks huge. So yeah, well we'll be out there. My sister, she's pregnant. So I'm supposed to go up down to Pennsylvania to see her when the baby's born in November. And I have a few more days of vacation this year, so I have to save it for that. And then start January 1st, I have, you know, the 3 weeks, so then I can set aside that time.
Cool.
To come out.
Yeah, I would lean towards summer, but anytime's fine with us.
Yeah.
It's very gray and rainy here most of the time. Mm-hmm. We get about 3 months of really good weather, and if you're going to be traveling around to see the countryside, sunny would be better.
Yeah. Yeah. So we should take our 2 week vacation in June, like the middle 2 weeks of June. How's the weather out there at that time?
It's very spring like here in June.
Mm-hmm.
It can sometimes still be rainy. I mean, it's sort of hit and miss.
Yeah.
But it is more springtime. It's pretty here in June.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That'll probably be around the time we come out then.
Well, that'd be fine.
So June. So expect us June.
All right.
Reservations.
Setting aside a couple weeks in June.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the interview or talk.
Well, thank you, Ken.
Yeah.
It's been awfully nice talking to you.
Yeah. You too. So we'll can't wait for your next do you have another episode coming up on your two episodes or just the one?
We just did one last night, but Andy's coming over. We got some other things we're trying to produce. He's gotten into the song making, so we have some work to do on his next one.
Wow, that was really clever, that meth song.
Yeah.
I was laughing.
He's a pretty cerebral guy when he wants to be. He sat down and worked that whole thing out and wrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it again and practiced it at home. And he just basically showed up and said, here, I want to lay this down. And we did it in one night. It was pretty easy. From my end, it was pretty easy. He did a lot more work than I did.
Yeah, it was very good. He's a good voice, too.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible.
Yeah, runs in the family, I guess, because his mother, I thought her voice was really good, too.
Yeah, so yeah, I did, too.
Does she sing, or what's her deal?
They all do. I mean, all those Wixes over there on that side of the table seem to enjoy it. Andy's daughter is a pretty good singer, too.
Oh, yeah, she was in...
Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, they're all pretty good, so I can't sing around them. The only thing I do on karaoke over here is Elvis now.
Uh-huh.
just because, you know, he's the king.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I've always been an Elvis and John Wayne fan, so.
Oh. I see. So let's see. Okay. Well, I'll let you get to dinner. I guess you're going to have dinner soon, or
it's like 6:20 here now.
6:20. Yeah.
You got to work tomorrow, huh?
Yeah. It's 9:25 here or 9:20, whatever. So I need to get ready. I have some soup too to eat. John made some chicken soup.
Ah. Well, I've been sharing a cold with the lovely and talented Wendy for the last couple of weeks, so maybe I'll have some chicken soup.
Oh, geez, yeah. You don't sound like you have a cold, but...
No, yeah. It's just a throat thing I'm having right now.
Really?
I'm on the tail end of it. Yeah.
Is it you're coughing a lot, too? Did you cough? Or?
I did. In fact, I've been fighting it here just so to save your eardrums.
Yeah. John, I mean, this past summer, John and I were both sick like three times with a cold. We'd get the cold... And it would go away and come back, but we'd always have this cough throughout the whole time. So I don't know what's – and I know other people, too, have had this cold.
Well, if my grandmother were alive, she would insist that it was the Russians.
I'm sure it is.
It's the Russians. They're sending over some virus over here or something.
Is this the Southern Baptist Southern Baptist? Grandmother?
Yeah, that's her. She always had a theory, and she was always right. So, no sense arguing with her. It's the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Well, it has been really nice talking to you, Ken.
Same here. Thanks a lot.
See you later.
You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at Kenty@theflatusshow.com.